Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here broadcasting live today from the world headquarters, I believe it is, certainly the New York headquarters of Liz Claiborne, Inc., where they're doing a Violence Against Women Awareness Day. And we'll be having a couple of guests dropping by and talking about that issue as we continue through the day. And it's going to be an interesting day. We're going to get Jim Martin on from who's running for the United States Senate from Georgia. And he will be with us in about 10, 15 minutes. And right now, Dr. Christian E. Weller is with us. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, associate professor of public policy at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and an expert in retirement income security, macroeconomics, money and banking, and international finance. AmericanProgress.org, of course, the website. Dr. Weller, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Given all of the money that's going into these bailouts, now we have the president of Ford saying that although he made $50 million over the last 18 months, he's willing to take a $1 a year salary for the next year. Gee, you know, it's pretty impressive, right? All these bailouts, none of the bankers are talking about taking a dollar. We don't know where all of this money is going. It doesn't seem to be filtering down to Main Street. What is the status of America's middle class, America's working people in the, you know, right now? Not just the companies like Ford and GM who employ so many of them. I suppose the banks do too, probably not anywhere near as large an extent and certainly not as unionized. But what's the status of the American middle class right now?
Well, the status of the American middle class is pretty dire. And often when I say this, people will point out and say, like, well, but incomes have gone up or people have more houses, they have more VCRs. And that's ultimately missing the point. I think what drives middle class standards of living but also middle class anxiety at this point is, do you have the means to protect yourself and your family if something goes wrong? Do you have enough insurance? Do you have enough wealth? And ultimately, do you have enough wealth and savings and income to create the opportunities that you want for you and your children? And those measures, they're often tied to how much people have saved, how much money they have in wealth. When you look at that, we have seen a sharp erosion of that financial security. And that, to my degree, even before the crisis hit, and that to a large degree explains, I think, the mental state of the middle class, that people are very anxious about their future, about their children's future. And it has only gotten worse. I mean, at this point, wealth is being destroyed by plummeting housing values, by plummeting financial market values, but also by plummeting jobs.
Right. Can you quantify that for us? I mean, for example, the level to which the average wealth of an American family or American household, 1950 versus today, or 1960 or 70 versus today.
We can't go back that far, but the indicator that we calculated is the share of families have 3 months of their income in financial wealth. And in 2007, by our estimates, it's a little bit over 29%. So less than one third of families can meet that threshold. In 2000, the last peak in that was 39%. So that there is a large, sharp drop. I mean, it was never the majority of people. And that goes to the overall insecurity that we've seen for decades. But it got a lot better during the 1990s. And then after 2000, it very quickly eroded. In 2008, quite frankly, it's like free fall.
Right. And there's another dimension to this, too, it seems. As in addition to a family having enough money to make it through a few months or you know, God forbid, a few years of unemployment or very hard times, there's the culture, the society, being able to support people as they make it through that. We did our show from Denmark in March of this year, and or perhaps it was June, whenever it was, anyway. And unemployment insurance in Denmark lasts for 2 years. If you're sick, it's, you know, I asked the functionally the vice president of the country, you know, what percentage of your people have to explore bankruptcy as an option as a consequence of getting sick. And, you know, she blinked at me like, what? You know, what are you talking about? Are you crazy? Social Security, even in the United States, I mean, 30 years ago, you couldn't retire well on Social Security, but you didn't have to worry about eating dog food. When most states required that hospitals and health insurance companies be not-for-profit companies, the cost of health care was a fraction of what it is today.
Well, that's exactly the point, that wealth nowadays has taken on a much larger meaning, because we have this on your own society where we leave individuals to fend for themselves to a much larger degree than we have in the past. So, we have this, paradox situation where basically people need to save a lot more to have the same level of overall protection than they did in the past. But at the same time, because of flat wages and declining benefits and the lack of job growth, we have fewer opportunities for people to save. And, so I think that volatile mix of the increased need and fewer opportunities to save is ultimately explaining the overall insecurity of America's families. I mean, we looked at the share of families who can fund, for instance, cover a medical emergency. And in 2000, there was about 44% of families who had enough wealth to cover a financial emergency. Nowadays, it's 34%. So that's a drop, again, by 10 percentage points. And that's a very sharp drop that's driven by the loss of wealth, by the loss of jobs, and by the rising cost of healthcare.
What is, looking in your crystal ball, Dr. Christian Weller, in the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, what the trend clearly isn't good. Where do you think that we're going, and what are the best solutions to this, in your opinion?
Well, there's no silver bullet. I think that's the important part. You're looking at basically three entryways for policy. The first one is you got to create jobs. You got to create jobs, and you got to create good-paying jobs and benefits. And that starts with things like an economic stimulus, an economic recovery package to create some jobs, but then also to improve labor law to make it easier for people to join a union. It goes along with an improved earned income tax credit. It goes along with a stronger minimum wage. Those kinds of things need to go in tandem together to really raise jobs and wages and benefits. The other part you got to do is you got to reduce the cost of borrowing money. That means better regulation of financial markets to weed out some of these bad apples and bad practices. And finally, you got to rein in some of the large cost increases that have really done a number on families' finances, and that means particularly we got to address, not on the healthcare side, we not only got to address health insurance coverage or the lack thereof, but also the incredible increases in healthcare costs. And I think there you can make the system much more efficient, you can cut out a lot of waste, and ultimately rein in some of those cost increases.
How do you respond to the folks, particularly the conservatives out there, who say, well, you know, if you do this, you're increasing spending. If you're going to increase spending, you're either going to borrow the money from China, you're going to increase taxes. If you increase taxes, it's going to slow down the economy. It seems that so many people have bought this. When you increase taxes, it slows down the economy. Yet when we look back at those times when we have had significant tax increases on the wealthy anyway in the United States, every single one of them seems to have corresponded with a time of increased prosperity in the United States.
Well, I mean, the other way to look at it is we had incredibly large regressive tax cuts after 2000. We had big tax cuts in 2001, one in 2003, and they were supposed to boost investment and employment growth.
Right.
The periods after the tax cuts were followed by employment growth that was half its long-term average, and we had an investment performance that was the lowest of any business cycle since the Great Depression.
Well, and you can go back to the 20s, and you can go back to the 80s, and in both cases, and this is the third one, I'd say the third big one, where there's a dramatic tax cut, and it is followed by a boom and bust.
Right. And so, I mean, because these supply side economics, what they don't do is they throw more money at rich people who then look for speculative opportunities to invest their money. And that doesn't really create jobs. It doesn't create good benefits. It doesn't stabilize an economy. And you get these boom and bust cycles. And I think the quick answer is, look, the tax cuts that we had in 2001, 2003 didn't do anything to the economy other than create a boom and bust cycle. So quite frankly, taking back the tax cuts from 2001, 2003 should stabilize the economy, should give us the resources, the government the resources to invest in our future so that we have more stronger and more stable long-term growth.
Yeah, very well said. Dr. Christian Weller of the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. Dr. Weller, thanks for dropping by today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Good speaking with you. It's 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program here on Air America Radio. Stick around. We're going to drop in and see how Jim Martin's doing down in Georgia.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the headquarters of Liz Claiborne in Manhattan. Their Violence Against Women Awareness Day. We'll be getting to that as the show continues. Right now, Jim Martin is with us. He's running against Saxby Chambliss in Georgia. This is the race that has the nation's attention, and today is Election Day. Jim Martin, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom, thank you for letting me be on your show.
Oh, thanks for coming on. I am so pleased. Martin for FOR, Senate, SANETATE.com is the website. Wherever you live, my listeners, wherever you live, anywhere in the United States, go through your address book, go into Outlook or whatever your program may be, you know, look for anybody who lives in the state of Georgia, call them, call all your friends and ask them if they know anybody who lives in the state of Georgia. I lived in Georgia for 13 years. I've called a bunch of people down there and I've sent a whole pile of emails off to folks that I knew all those years I lived in Atlanta, ran two different businesses. If you have any connection with the state of Georgia, get your friends out to vote today. Now, beyond my saying that, Jim, what's your pitch?
Well, we want to go to Washington to work with our new president to deal with the difficult issues this country faces. You know, Saxby Chambliss has been running a very negative campaign against me, like the campaign he ran against Max Cleland 6 years ago, not on the issues, personal attacks. The issue really is how we go about moving this economy forward. I want to work with our new president to make sure that we make the economy fair for the middle class and keep people working. The new president has identified or stated that there's a possibility of losing 2 million additional jobs in our economy unless we pass a stimulus package that helps protect the middle class. I want to come to Washington to help him do that, and we've lost 96,000 jobs in Georgia this year alone. So these are difficult economic times. There's hope. He's put together an extraordinary economic team. He's put together a wonderful foreign policy team. The question really for Georgians is whether or not we want a senator who will go to Washington to work with the new president and represent the interests of Georgia effectively, or somebody who's going to stand in the way.
Jim Martin, you're singing to the choir. We've got probably, about 8 hours left in this day for people to vote?
It's about halfway through.
How can people, if somebody's listening, you know, live on our affiliate in San Francisco or Los Angeles or Detroit, or if they're listening in Denver, or if they're listening to the web stream someplace in Canada or what, you know, anybody, how can our listeners most directly impact the probability that people are going to get? For example, even at this late hour, are you accepting people who will say, hey, give me a list of who can contact you, and you'll give them people to call? I mean,
That's right. They can go on my website, and there's a way in order to do some phone calling for me. The most important thing, though, frankly, would be for folks who know people in Georgia, if they would just call them and say, this race is about who wants it the most. That's what President Clinton said when he came to Georgia a week ago to campaign for me, and he's absolutely correct. It's going to be a very tight race. because this is a runoff election, the turnout is problematic, and every vote counts. So if any of your listeners know somebody in Georgia, if they would give them a call and just encourage them to go to the polls and say this really is about whether somebody's going to go to Washington to work for change and work with a new president, or as Sexby Chambliss has said, he will go to Washington to be a firewall against the president and prevent the any kind of action that will change where we are in this economy.
So if I go to martinforsenate.com,
yes,
your website, Jim Martin, if I go to martinforsenate.com, what do I do? How do I pick up a list of 10, 20, 30, whatever the tranche is, whatever the slice is, that of people that I don't know that I can call in Georgia from wherever I happen to live to help, get them out to vote? How do I do that?
Okay, I've just been instructed this. People need to go to mybarackobama.com, and then they can click on calls for Jim on that website. Campaign for Change is helping me. We kept those offices open after we worked together in the general election.
Right.
We've kept those open. So
it's mybarackobama.com.
That's right. And then go for calls for Jim. Click on that, and that you can get a list of people to call.
Great.
And I'm glad I was corrected by my staff on that.
Yeah, me too. Because we want to get as many, as we're seeing in Minnesota. Sometimes these races, as we saw in Alaska, we did this with Mark Begich on this show a couple
right.
of times. Get every friend you know in Alaska out there. We did it with Al Franken.
Makes a difference.
Hopefully, it really does. And this race might come down to 100 votes. Who knows? And
right.
and if it does, wouldn't it be great if whoever, if our listeners, if you can call 20 people, you can call 30 people, you can call 50 people, if you can spend the rest of the day. Here's 8 hours that you can put into your day, or I think it's about 8 hours till the polls close in Georgia, and that you can participate in helping. This is not just a Georgia election, frankly. You would become the supermajority vote, or certainly could become.
Well, our new president really has talked about working across party lines. There's a lot been made of this 60 of voting. I think once that has been resolved, though, our new president will work with Republicans and Democrats to make sure we move this country forward. It really takes that partisan issue off the table. And that allows us to move beyond the partisanship to really working together to solve problems. That's exactly the call that our new president made when he won the election on that Tuesday night in November, when he addressed the nation in Chicago. He's talked about the old politics that's just sort of poisoned our politics for so long. And I want to go to Washington to help him be successful.
And I want you to as well. Jim Martin, mybarackobama.com. There's a link on there where you can pick up a list of folks to call in Georgia. And if you have anybody in Georgia in your phone directory, give them a shout. All your friends, people you haven't heard from for 20 years, give them a call. Go through your Christmas card list. And, of course, martinforsenate.com. Thanks, Jim Martin.
Thanks, Tom. I really appreciate your help.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast on Air America Radio. And Dr. Anne Renee Testa is with us. And here's a pair of headphones for you,
thank
Doctor.
You.
Welcome to the program. You are a media expert, author, a psychologist, a relationship coach, corporate lecturer. We're talking here. We're at the Liz Claiborne, the world headquarters, or the
yes.
it seems, and surrounded by some great people. And this whole issue of violence against women from small local, and I don't mean small in a diminutive way, but I mean, you know, little kids in schools, to the news report that I saw today that was in The Guardian in the UK that it is possible now to hire a hitman to kill your wife for $100 in Iraq. That's the going price to murder for an honor killing, and there's no prosecution of this. If, you know, a new bride is not a virgin, if a young girl dishonors her family, if somebody wants to divorce his wife, $100 for the killing. And this is now standard operating procedure in Iraq.
In the UK?
No, the UK published the story. It was the story in The Guardian, but this is in Iraq.
Oh, my.
And, I mean, this is the hell on earth that we've unleashed, among other things. But, mm-hmm. I mean, it's a symptom of this whole thing. So from the very large or the very terrible to the things that bring this about. I mean, bullying in school, for example. You're a real authority on bullying in relationships.
Yes.
Tell us about this as a dimension of the problems of life in America, and how does our economic disaster right now tie in with this?
Well, maybe I'll go a little backwards and say about the economic disaster. If you think about it, there are more divorces now than there ever have been, and the financial pressure on a marriage is huge. And what happens is when a couple are sort of shoveling things under the rug. Let's say you're married 15, 20 years and you've shoveled the financial stuff under the rug, but also the emotional things in a marriage.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden when this is happening and the pressure is on and you can't go around it, you've got to go through it. All of that stress is coming piling down on couples, a lot of couples, and it's creating a huge amount of stress, and some couples are getting divorced.
So the middle class, one of the themes of this week that we've been talking about is the middle class is disappearing is perhaps too strong a word, but under tremendous stress in the United States. Violence against women, violence within marriages, bullying in school, all of these are perhaps not oddly, perhaps commonsensically, you know, tragically, but, you know, a dimension of this economic crisis.
Well, yes, I think it becomes a pressure cooker. And think about it. You know, I believe that children are born innocent and pure, that there are no bad seeds. Sometimes there's a wiring in the brain and someone has a proclivity to something, you know, but not about bullying. And there was a study that just happened about 3-4 weeks ago that I was going to write into the New York Times. They said that bullies have a special gene, and I thought, no way in
yeah.
No way do bullies have a special gene. What happens is you watch the behavior as a little kid growing up.
It's
think
learned.
About this.
This is nurture,
learned
not
behavior.
Nature.
You better believe it.
Yeah. Now your first book was Glass Houses, and you explored not just Bill Clinton's infidelity, but the hypocrisy of, my recollection is every single member of the leadership of the Republican Party that was prosecuting him, they were getting it on the side at the same time. My
yes.
congressman at the time, Newt Gingrich, certainly was. Bob Barr was. There was a whole bunch of them.
Oh, yes.
Here's the book.
Okay.
And now you have this, what's called the ART method, A-R-T method for dealing with bullies.
Yes. I think that actually it's a problem-solving way of taking care of any problem whatsoever, and it's about assessing a situation, looking at it from all angles. Take a look at not just from the, you know, face on, but look at the problem from all angles, your angle, the other person's angle, if you can do that, and then reassess it. Take a good look around the entire problem, and then take action. The taking action part is the most important part because, you know, we can moan about our, you know, a boss, a spouse, a child. But in fact, if we don't take positive action and learn what the healthy model is all about, and it's about learning what the healthy model is all about, then the problem keeps on multiplying. And it's sort of like this ugly cancer that grows inside a relationship and also inside a child because we are so vulnerable as children.
Yeah. And your new book is The Bully in Your Relationship, Stop Emotional Abuse and Get the Love You Deserve. We're talking with Anne Renee Testa, Ph.D., and Dr. Anne Renee Testa. And just in summary, what we have to move along to callers and things here, but
good.
In summary, what is the state of America now relative to 10, 20, 30 years ago in terms of consciousness of these issues and in terms of the of this being a problem? The bullying.
The bullying problem, as you know, is an epidemic right now. And I do believe that it was always a kind of epidemic, only we're giving it a life and we're bringing it to the surface and we're talking about it.
Yeah.
And we're also trying to solve it and fix these kids that blow themselves up in a school, Cho in Virginia Tech and things that, like that that are happening that never happened before. There's a huge amount of stress on everyone now. And hopefully with this new administration and hopefully with the market and everything else kind of up the road, managing itself better. I think we're learning a great deal. Out of negativity, I always believe, comes some positive stuff.
One quick last question. I'm old enough to remember Jackie Gleason. And
you're not.
I am. And, you know, to the moon, Alice, you know, and he would, you know, wave his fist at her, and she would always just back him right back down. And on the one level, looking back at those old honeymooners, you know, they were in one way kind of marvelous in that they reflected middle class working America, which pretty much doesn't happen anymore on television. There was the hero who was the average person, and Alice, you know, her inner strength came through pretty strongly. On the other hand, I watch it and I cringe because he's cartooning, he's aping violence against women or the threat of it.
Yes.
And as a society, we just kind of ignored it because nobody was talking about it.
Yeah.
I'm curious about your thoughts on those honeymooners episodes and how, you know, clearly that could not happen in today's television. But at the same time, has the problem gotten worse because, you know, I don't quite have the words for this, but you get the gestalt here that I'm talking about.
I do. It's a good question. I think that we are so out on the table with all of these problems now that they're right in front of us, and that in fact today it's more, it seems as though it's more prevalent, and we talk about stress and we use that as an excuse for bullying and all the rest. I think that that problem has always existed. The thing is that, thank goodness, it's out. It's out and we're talking about it. We're doing a show like this. We're helping people to understand that, no, it's not right to hit someone. No, it's not right. And in my book, The Bully in Your Relationship, it's about verbal abuse, which is the worst abuse. So it's out there. It's my book. It's other books where we're talking about it and we're giving solutions.
And verbal abuse is the worst because it creates psychic wounds that disable people in their ability to function in every other dimension of their lives rather than simply a physical injury.
That's right. I mean, you think that a physical injury would be the worst, but it really isn't, even though I don't condone that.
Well, you look at the Kauai studies, you know, physically abused children were actually the more resilient than children who didn't face that over time.
Yes, and how interesting is that?
Yeah.
But when you have emotional abuse, it is a horror because it's insidious and it's ugly.
Yeah.
And I have a patient that used to cringe when she'd come home from school because she knew that her father would yell and call her stupid. Well, now she's somebody that's, you know, a big money person, and I hope a healthy company right now.
Right.
But the point is that made,
I'm sure there's
havoc with her emotions.
Yeah, I'm sure there's still a little voice inside going, stupid.
Yes, you know, it's so true. And I've helped her in the boardroom and all of that good stuff, you know, deal with everyone around the table and so forth. So it's out there, in answer to your question.
That's great.
As long as we're doing this work, as long as you're talking about it.
Thank you. Anne Marie Testa, PhD, her new book, The Bully in Your Relationship, Stop Emotional Abuse and Get the Love You Deserve. We have just a minute until the break. Miles in Portland, Oregon has a comment about bullying in school. Let's just bring Miles in on this conversation here before we wrap it up. Miles, you're on the air.
Yeah, well, I think part of the reason that we have this problem in school is that the people who are trying to stop it, like the school counselors, they don't know how to talk to kids. They make us do all of this really annoying stuff about anti-bullying. All it does is make people just kind of phase out.
You're a kid in school, Miles?
Yes, in Portland.
And you think that the anti-bullying training is ineffective?
Completely. It's just, whenever the counselor does a class, everyone's really mean to her because she won't do anything about it, and she just, you know, they don't know how to control kids at all.
Right.
Any thoughts in the few seconds we have left?
Is this a parent that we're hearing?
This is a child. This is a kid who's in school. He says the anti-bullying training that they're getting in schools is doing no help.
You know, the real key to bullying and to stopping a bully, so you're a victim?
Yeah, we have to.
Okay, is stand down. Don't be afraid. Take your fear and lock it at the door and stand up and look straight in the eyes of the bully and say, don't do that to me anymore. I don't like it. I don't want you to do it again. And be strong about it.
It ain't going to happen. There you go. 45 minutes past the hour. And Renee Testa.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
I climbed across the mountain tops, swam all across the ocean blue, across over land and local
rules. 9.5 minutes before the hour, it's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, supporting the Employee Free Choice Act, teamster.org, for more information. 866-303-2270 is our telephone number. And George in Los Angeles, you wanted to get in on the tail end of our conversation about bullying. And by the way, when I said it ain't going to happen, I meant you need to tell the bully it ain't going to happen, not that it wouldn't be possible to talk back to a bully. George, you're on.
It sounds like bullying is a disease, and it's part of the social ills of this world that causes all the homophobia and wars and economic bullying and misogynism, and everybody needs to dominate the other to feel like they have a little bit of dignity, maybe, or they're just afraid of being disrespected, when in fact they're just operating hypocritically and disrespecting others through their bullying. But fear overcomes all that common sense.
Yeah, I think for a small but significant slice of our populace, you know, that's very much the case. Well,
it's
said,
everybody.
You think
everybody
it is? You think
would
it
agree.
Is? Yeah, I guess those seeds are. Yeah, you're probably right, George. Those seeds are probably in all of us. Thanks for the call, Bob Cosienda.
Cosienda, yes.
Bob Cosienda is with us. He's the founder of the Center for Youth Leadership in Fairfield, Connecticut. We're broadcasting our show live today from Liz Claiborne, where they're doing a Violence Against Women Awareness Day. And, Bob, you've established the Center for Youth Leadership, the largest youth activism organization in Fairfield County, Connecticut, one of the largest in the state. What's up with this?
The Center for Youth Leadership is actually at 4 high schools in Fairfield County, Connecticut. We work with 225 teens, and they address 4 issues, child abuse, day laborers, human trafficking, and the issue we're here to talk about today, which is teen dating violence.
And, you know, I don't think most people realize that, what was it, 40% of girls between 14 and 17 or 13 and 17 report that they have been victims of violence.
Between 13 and 17, correct.
On a date. I mean,
correct.
That's astounding.
It is.
Is that higher than it was 30 years ago?
It is higher. When you look at statistics in Connecticut, for example, it's significantly lower than national stats. It's at 13%. Hmm. But the research that we did in Fairfield County, it's actually double the state average, Connecticut being 13%. Ours in Fairfield County is 26%. And that's for physical violence only. The numbers jump off the charts when you address emotional and verbal abuse, which in our research shows is much more prevalent than the physical violence.
Right, and our last guest said can be much more destructive if it's sustained. Now, is this the result of better reporting? I know we've seen in many areas stats, you know, suddenly explode, you know, and after there's a TV show about something and suddenly it's because there's better reporting. Or is this that, you know, the economy is getting bad, things are getting or is this the culture, the rough culture, the gangster rap culture or whatever? I mean, that's one slice, but, you know, this pervades every race and every part of, you know, the objectification of women, frankly. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's You know, it's the way we sell cars now. I mean, what do you think are the drivers of this?
I think you can address the three things that you mentioned definitely contribute to it. The one that we focus on, though, is the increased reporting. Teens typically do not report this for reasons of shame primarily, but any high school that we go into that wants to adopt the programs that we run, we ask that they not keep this underground, that they not keep it hush-hush. If they're going to adopt the programs that we run, they have to blow the cover off of teen dating violence so that it becomes very, very normal to talk about. I know that's somewhat of a leap in certain schools and in certain communities, but that's one of the things that we definitely push.
Yeah. And how does a kid do that?
Well, it takes a lot of education, first of all.
I mean, is it school counselor? Is it teacher? Is it parent? Is it pushing back on your own?
It's all those things. First, the teen has to have a lot of guts to come forward emotionally to report an abuse case, especially if it's emotional or verbal, because we have found that to be very, very very severe. But then it also starts at the top of a school district and a school. You need to educate people about teen dating violence, how to recognize it, and how to intervene. For example, one of the initiatives that we are undertaking as of January is we're sending teams of students, high school students, into high schools to conduct audits of their schools from a safety perspective relative to teen dating violence. So, for example, is there a curriculum in the building that's being used and has it been evaluated? Security guards, have their training that they go through, does it include teen dating violence, social workers, guidance counselors, and the like.
Yeah.
The toughest part is going to be the teachers union. To get teachers to stay after school, for example, to go for additional training, it's going to take a lot of negotiating on our part with unions to get them to stay and to recognize that teachers, along with teenagers, are on the front lines of recognizing it and seeing it and intervening.
How do we change the culture in this country and around the world?
Yeah, it's really, really tough, Tom. You mentioned the music before. I think that does contribute to it. But then there's just this general acceptance of violence against women seems to be okay.
But isn't that secondary to the objectification of women?
Without a doubt. We see that. I mentioned earlier one of the issues that we address in addition to teen dating violence is human trafficking. Most people recognize that as an international phenomenon. It's not. It's happening right in our own backyards, and women are just talked down to completely, and I'm just talking about on a teen level, they're talked down to completely. They're always objectified in terms of what they wear. Maybe you should be wearing this as opposed to wearing that because I can see more of your skin, so on and so forth.
Right. Yeah, I worked in the advertising industry for a lot of years. I can tell you how carefully.
And what sells, Tom?
Pardon?
What sells?
Well, sex sells. You know.
Yeah.
Well, actually, sex doesn't sell. Sex gets attention. And there are times when sex actually diminishes sales because it draws away from the message of the ad.
That's it, right.
But that's a whole other conversation.
Right.
Objectivizing women is something that is often done as a subset of trying to get attention unnecessarily. Frankly.
Fair point, right.
And then they're
seen as property, as chattel, and then men or boys can do with them as they like.
That's right. And then boom, you're right into the situation of violence against women being accepted from bullying and abuse and, you know, women, girls being beat up in junior high school in the United States to $100 to buy for a hitman in Iraq right now is the going price to kill your wife, $100, no crime, no penalty, no prosecutions. Big story in The Guardian today.
I saw that, yeah.
Yeah. This is the spectrum of the crisis that we're facing, I think, in the worldwide industrialized culture.
Sure.
Bob Cosienda, is there a website, quickly?
Sure, www.gocyl.org.
Thank you, Bob.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from New York. Michael Mandel is with us. He's the chief economist for Businessweek magazine and author of the new textbook, Economics, The Basics, businessweek.com, the website. Michael Mandel, welcome to the show.
Oh, glad to be here.
Glad to have you. The economy right now is on everybody's mind. The status of the American middle class, the future of the American middle class, and I want to get into some of the structural stuff that has brought this about. Your article, I believe this is in Business Week, November 25th, starts up. President-elect Barack Obama has made a promise.
yet the promise to sort of generate 2.5 million jobs, and whether or not he'll be able to fulfill that promise.
Right. Now, if you look back at, for example, Alexander Hamilton's 1791 letter on, oh, it was more than a letter, his report on manufacturers to Congress, in which he laid out an industrial policy for the United States that essentially stood up until the mid-1980s. That you know, turned this nation into an industrial powerhouse. We had average tariffs during that time that over that entire 200-year period that averaged around 20-25%. Our average tariff now is under 2%. In the early 70s, I owned a company, Langley St. Clair Instrumentation Systems. We did business in Japan and imported products in Japan. We joint ventured with two companies in Japan, and we had a joint venture with them because their laws were such that I couldn't just go into Japan and set up a factory to make something. You know, I had to have a Japanese partner. They very much protect their markets in Japan. They're protecting their markets in China right now. Korea built its nation protecting its markets. How do we have these jobs? You talk about the original Buy American Act signed by Herbert Hoover in 1933. How do we bring jobs to the United States when, lacking these things?
That's such a good question. But, you know, right at this point, I mean, a lot of the reporting and stories I've done over the last couple of years suggest that the problems in manufacturing are actually a lot worse than we ever thought that they were, that the statistics have been really misleading, and that, in fact, that the hollowing out of the U.S. manufacturing sector has been really pretty horrible. And the question that we face right now is what do we do about that? And sort of at what end do we start with? Do we start at the high end? Do we protect low end jobs? What do we have to do to sort of manage this in the global economy? That's a very, very difficult question at this point. I've always believed that financing innovation was the right way, but I'm really not 100% sure at this point that's the solution.
40%, it's actually a little over 40% of all international trade that involves the United States is intra-company trade. It's Hewlett-Packard, a U.S. company, setting up a factory that they wholly own in China.
That's right.
And manufacturing printers in China and then selling themselves to the United States, into the United States, with a tariff that's under 1.5% for an imported printer. Where, on the other hand, if you wanted to manufacture a printer in the United States and sell it into China, you're looking at 10, 12, 14% tariffs. You want to sell a car made in the United States into China, it's 22% import tariff into China. They're protecting their markets. This is not trade. This has got nothing to do with trade. This is a scam or a scheme of some sort. I lack a word for it. Maybe you've got one, to simply arbitrage labor.
It's, you know, what we sort of saw starting in the late 1990s, and it was an expansion of U.S. multinationals overseas, taking advantage of cheaper labor and actually also government subsidies in other countries. You know, one question, for example, is whether or not the right thing to do is to sort of subsidize certain investments here.
Or why not reinstate tariffs?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, historically speaking, tariffs, I'm not sure that tariffs have sort of been the right idea. The question you'd want to ask at that point, and I'm not saying that they aren't, the question you want to say is, are you likely to sort of trigger off a round of global tariff hikes from that, which leaves everybody better off? Or is there a way to, you know, reinstitute U.S. manufacturing without going that route?
With 7 billion people in the world, I mean, there's a huge labor pool. There's never going to be a shortage of people who are willing to work for under a dollar an hour. Never, ever, ever. And it seems that the only way that any economy can protect itself is to create an economic membrane around itself, as the successful economies in the world are doing. I mean, Bush was down in Peru. I'm assuming you saw his speech when he was in Peru. Blew my mind. He said, free trade has built South Korea. free trade has built Japan. No, it wasn't true. I mean, the major export of South Korea in 1955 was human hair for wigs. The average income was $500, and it was tariffs and huge subsidies to their heavy manufacturing industries and to their electronics industries that created South Korea as an economic powerhouse. It had nothing to do with free trade. It had to do with trade, but not free trade. And the same thing for Japan. And then he was quoting...
The question really is at this point is what is the best way? You know, we've seen a situation of falling real wages in the U.S. over the last few years, even for people who are not directly affected by trade. So the real question here is how do we raise real wages? And the place where I start from, okay, is that the best way to do this is to sort of innovate our way out of this as opposed to protecting our way out of this.
But let me just finish here.
Mm. But you know, you do stop and you do look and you sort of say, even for somebody like me who sort of is a very big supporter of the global economy, the events of recent years do kind of raise questions about it. You have to raise questions in pretty much anybody's mind about to what extent things have been sort of moving in the right direction. And let me give you an example here, which in some sense, part of the reason why we're in this situation is because we borrowed an enormous amount of money from the rest of the world to pay for imports. Now that doesn't do anybody any good. Mm-hmm. Now we did this in part to sort of,
it did China a lot of good. I said it did China a lot of good.
Well, it did them a lot of good in the short run. I think if you look at a year from now, whereas China's having a massive slowdown, I suspect what you're going to see a year from now or 2 years from now is that China's actually going to be considerably worse shape than the U.S. is.
Hmm.
I guess what I'm saying is that a lot of the reporting that I've done over the last couple of years has really given me sort of pause about whether or not we were moving on the right track. I'm frankly more worried about the breakdown of the global political system than I am about the breakdown of the global economic system.
Hmm.
That is to say, I what worries me from a historical point of view is the prospect of big wars. Okay,
hot wars. You mean? Like India, Pakistan, hot wars.
I'm more worried about that than in some sense that I am about, you know, the sort of economic crises. But the fact of the matter is, it's clear that the U.S. economy, in some fundamental sense, has fallen down on the job. And the question is, what's the right diagnosis? What's the right cure? What you're arguing for is trade barriers. I guess my feeling is that's a little bit like amputation. You go ahead and you do it if you've absolutely got to, but you try other things first.
Yeah.
So I would have even said this a year ago, but it is true that we've just gone through a long period, of falling real wages for most Americans, including ones with a fair amount of education.
Yeah, yeah. We're talking with Michael Mandel. He is the chief. Mandel, the chief economist for Business Week magazine and author of a new textbook, Economics, the Basics. We have about a half a minute left, Michael. Businessweek.com, by the way, the website. What would be the top advice you'd give Barack Obama?
Well, at this point, it's just to be sort of super aggressive about investing in the U.S., okay? Investing in infrastructure, investing in innovation, investing in education. This is a time for him to sort of roll out his biggest long-run plans and not to sort of be scared of them.
But if he says, we're going to put solar panels in every school in America, how do we keep those solar panels from being made in China?
That's like a very good question. And what I wrote in my story, I said if I raise that question, there's certain investments like education directly and healthcare and stuff that stays in the U.S., other things may leak out.
Yeah, it's going to be a tough one. I agree. There's no easy answers here, and it's going to be a tough one. Michael Mandel, the chief economist for Business Week magazine, author of the new textbook, Economics, the Basics, businessweek.com. Thank you, Michael, for being with us.
Thanks very much.
Great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman program broadcasting live today from Liz Claiborne's world headquarters, their activism on Violence Against Women Day. We'll continue with that, too.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, here's the one from the wire service that says, as we like to say, in a landmark deal that could provide much-needed cash to America's anemic economy, China agreed today to acquire the naming rights to the United States for a reported $1.4 trillion. The deal, which is expected to be signed by President George W. Bush and Chinese President Hu Jintao sometime before Inauguration Day on January 20th, was hailed today by Mr. Bush as a win-win for both countries. We get $1.4 trillion, Mr. Bush told reporters at the White House, and all we have to do is change the name of our country to Panda Garden. The president said he decided to make the extraordinary deal after being shocked to learn that the U.S. was in a recession when it was reported yesterday in the magazine he reads, Duh Magazine. According to President Hu, the Chinese had originally inquired about purchasing the rights to two American sports facilities named after troubled companies, Ford Field Detroit and Citi Field New York, but then decided it might be more cost efficient to buy the rights to the whole shebang. In addition to the $1.4 trillion, the Chinese government said it would provide $10 million to commission a new national anthem that would somehow incorporate the words Panda Garden into the lyrics and to redesign the nation's flag, which will henceforth be known as the Stars, Stripes, and Adorable Bear. Tip of the hat to Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com, for that. Geez, it might be a look at the news. By the way, serious news. President-elect Barack Obama considering a stimulus package, a heavy dose of spending on environmentally friendly projects. This, again, I'm telling you, if we don't go back to rational trade policies, we're simply going to say, oh, yeah, let's spend $1 trillion on solar panels. Where are we going to get them? We'll buy them from China. Right now, we're putting windmills all over the United States. Guess who's making them? Vesta in Denmark. Also in the news, an independent bipartisan congressionally mandated task force has concluded that the odds are... This is serious. This is the real news now. The odds are the terrorists will strike a major city with weapons of mass destruction. These odds are now better than even. The report singled out Pakistan as a grave concern because of its terrorist networks, histories of instability, and arsenal of several dozen nuclear warheads. This from an independent, bipartisan, congressionally mandated task force. I would add to that that, well, I don't want to go off on Pakistan too much, but I just... You know, ISI's involvement with 9/11 and the whole thing, you know, the Bush administration was caught so flat-footed, and how they were able to, for all these years, try to convince some small percentage of Americans that they were somehow keeping America safe when they failed to see 9/11 coming and do anything about it blows my mind. And in India, you know, people are asking Mr. Singh, the prime minister, they're saying, you know, how could you have let this happen? Nobody in America even asked that question of George Bush. Remember? Talk about a media asleep at the switch. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Elizabeth in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Elizabeth, welcome to the show. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my question. I actually have a question and a comment regarding what you were talking about yesterday, the article from the Financial Times. Mm-hmm. And my first question is that some of the things you said created in a few people I know that love your show a sense of mild to less mild panic. If the economy is completely going to crash, what do we do exactly for people who have, you know, a very small amount of savings or medium amount of savings? Do we take it all out of the stock market, our investments, you know, that are safe, kind of stable, conservative things? And after you answer that, I just want to say as a comment, you keep talking about manufacturing, and while I agree that that makes a lot of sense, it seems kind of old paradigm to me. Like you mentioned China as having this great financial system, but their pollution level and living in those cities, I mean, none of us would want that. And You know, I just
that's because they're doing manufacturing on the cheap, Elizabeth. You know, it is possible. I mean, look at Germany. Germany is the leading exporter of finished goods, high-level finished goods in the world. And their air is just fine, thank you very much. They're doing manufacturing very well. They're protecting much of their manufacturing industries, and they're doing it clean. Pollution doesn't always come along with manufacturing. It comes along with sloppy manufacturing. But the fact of the matter is that what I said yesterday is the essential economic truth that people don't get. And yes, it's old paradigm, because it's the only paradigm there is. I mean, it literally goes back to Aristotle. It literally goes back to Sumeria and Gilgamesh, that transforming something of little value into something of greater value by the addition of human labor, whether that's in the agricultural field, whether that's in the making food, which is a form of manufacturing, or whether that's making goods, a form of manufacturing, is actually creating wealth. That's the only way to create wealth. Saying, do you want fries with that, does not create wealth. You know, arguably, turning the potatoes into French fries creates wealth. But a service economy is, in my opinion, an oxymoron. As to, you know, what to do about this, how should we invest, what should we do with what little savings we have, and I'm in that category too, I don't honestly know. I do know that we as a country have always pulled together. We got through the Great Depression. We got through actually worse than that in the 1890s. We've been through some really, really tough times in this country. The Civil War was hell on wheels for this country. We got through that. We will get through this too, and we have to just be committed to that. But first we have to start talking about, and thank you for the call, Elizabeth, we have to start talking about these economic realities that people have been in denial about ever since Reagan came along with this whole deregulate everything and turn the international economy over to transnational corporations.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call
4 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border on Air America Radio. Stephanie Nilva is the executive director of Day One, an organization that partners with New York City youth to end dating abuse and domestic violence through community education, supportive services, legal advocacy, and leadership development. Stephanie, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Today, of course, we're broadcasting live from the Liz Claiborne World Empire headquarters in Manhattan, and on this issue. So let's look at these individual pieces of this: community education, supportive services, legal advocacy, and leadership development. How do you do each of those four things?
Essentially, what Day One offers throughout New York City is a combination of prevention for young people and direct legal services. So we're a legal organization assisting young people who may have been victimized in an intimate partner relationship, and we're also offering preventive education in schools and youth programs so that we can keep young people from ever getting involved in any violence in their intimate partnerships.
And so this, you say intimate partnerships, you're talking not just about date rape, though. You're talking about physical violence as well.
Much more emotional. Extensive. Yeah, exactly. The abusive relationships for young people and adults extend from everything from verbal abuse and emotional abuse to physical violence and sexual assault. Right. So it could be something like you see often controlling relationships among young people involving boyfriend-girlfriend things where the boy's telling the girl what to wear, where to go. You can't go to this party. I don't want you talking to any other guys. I don't like the way you dress. You can't wear those things if you're going out with me, things like that. So controlling behavior that can become violent over time,
right,
and can include all the things that you think of it as a customary domestic violence relationship.
Aren't those kinds of behaviors, in fact, early warning signs? of the potential for violence down the road?
Yes, and it's something that parents can keep an eye out for, because that type of control or verbal abuse, name-calling, and so on, can, if overlooked, could become violent over time. And we're talking about patterns. We're not talking about getting into an argument with your boyfriend or girlfriend, and then you don't agree on whether to get pizza or to get sandwiches. It's more about an extensive thing that happens repeatedly.
This is really about, it seems, correct me if I'm wrong, it's really about an underlying assumption in the relationship that one person owns the other.
That's true. All forms of abuse in relationships tie back to control. So it can be that you're controlling somebody by telling them, again, like I said, where to go and what to wear. It can also be extending control over them through threats or sexual assault or threats of violence.
Right, but it's all predicated by that objectification of one person as an other rather than the two of us as a we, and the definition of all the control in the hands of typically the man.
Although statistically, it's more frequently the man, but it happens both directions. It happens in same-sex relationships as well.
Yeah. And it seems that this is the sort of thing that, you rarely see as a theme for a TV show or anything like that. It's not much discussed. It's not made fun of in comedies. It's not dealt with in dramas. It's not, movies are not made out of it, unless it's the crazed stalker type, the extreme stereotype.
Right.
And yet the statistics on violence experienced, particularly by girls in the ages of early adolescence, 13 to 17 or 11 to 17, 11 to 14 here, half of all tweens, 11 to 14, have experienced this. This is huge.
It is. It's a common misperception that it's happening either less frequently or not at all among young people. And I have to say, I'm a lawyer. I've been a lawyer 15 years. I used to work with adults. And if you'd asked me at the time, how often do you think this is happening among youth, I would never have known the numbers. But truthfully, it is roughly the same among adults. In fact, young people 16 to 24 nationwide experience more abuse than any other age group.
Is it that people who experience abuse as adults allow, and I use that word in quotes, allow themselves, because I very much get it that this isn't something that somebody says, hey, I think I'll go out and be an abuse victim this week, but that they find themselves in these kind of situations or whatever because they're simply repeating a pattern that they might have started when they were 12 years old?
That could be the case. What you see, if this is what you're getting at, among young people, one of the reons you see a prevalence is that these are their first relationships. Young people don't have a lot of experience. They don't have a lot to compare it to. So if it's your very first boyfriend and you're kind of caught up in that experience and the social status that comes with that sort of thing, and everybody thinks he's so cute and he's so popular and he buys you things and that's all great and everything, there's a lot of peer pressure to have a partner. And so people tend to, again, without a lot of, maybe they don't have good models, possibly they're not seeing something good at home, or the media is not giving people terrific examples of healthy relationships either. So they don't come to recognize it, and as a result, people feel very isolated. They feel like they're the only person who's ever gone through this, so they don't come forward. Or if they come forward, they talk to their friends, so they don't get a lot of accurate information about
it. Right. We're talking with attorney Stephanie Nilva, the executive director of Day One here in New York. Where I was going with the logic train on that was if, in particular young girls, but as you said, it can happen to boys and it happens in same-sex relationships as well. If people experience this kind of thing in pre-adolescent or adolescent situations, and they don't push back, they don't say no, they don't say this is not going to stand, I will not put up with being beaten up, or they don't break that cycle, then they're more likely to repeat the cycle. Whereas if they do break the cycle, and if we can educate them to break that, or just the first instance of it, if they do break it, then they're less likely to end up in that kind of a situation later in life. Is that a truism, or is it just a nice cliche?
But I want to shift the focus a little bit away from people setting limits against being abused and kind of more focused on the perpetrators of the abuse, because like you were saying before, I know you recognize that people don't find or seek out abusive relationships.
Right.
They don't come to, people often ask me, do these women have low self-esteem? Is that why they're being abused?
Right.
Women enter relationships and they develop low self-esteem because they're with a partner who's telling them you're worthless, you're never going to do any better, nobody else is going to want you. And over time, that can really take effect again, especially if you're young and you don't have a lot of positive framework to compare that to.
Is there some extension, pardon me interrupting you, Is there some extension, though, from kids who have been told through childhood that they're no good, that they're stupid, that they're unattractive, they're whatever, you know, carrying that forward?
I mean, there's a possibility. I mean, as a lawyer and not a social scientist, I'm going
right.
to
okay.
leave
yeah,
that
right.
aside. But I think that there are statistical studies that show that exposure to abuse in the home is a powerful indicator that somebody could become either a victim or an abuser, depending on what they've witnessed.
So they're modeling their parents.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, Stephanie Nilva, as an attorney, you know, what's your advice?
Well, for parents, I think keeping an eye out for the subtler forms of abuse that you can see, you know, kind of the controlling behavior, the making all the decisions, the name-calling, and the really subtle forms that could become violent over time. But also, parents should think really carefully about being supportive of their young people, about taking their issues seriously. When I'm speaking to a group of adults, I usually ask them to close their eyes for everybody out in Radioland and really remember what it was like to be in your first relationship. Because if you can't recall how powerful those feelings are and how seriously you took it, then you're not going to be able to act as a supportive presence for a young person, whether you're a teacher or a parent, who is saying, I can't break up with him, I don't want to break up with her, you know, and they have to be able to understand that this is a very serious thing. This is not, using the terms like puppy love and being dismissive of what your young people are telling you can be really dangerous.
And yet, I think many parents and, you know, many parents these days, given all the stresses that are on families, particularly economic stresses, find it hard to even have the time, much less taking that time to dig deep into that empathy well that you're talking about. Teachers are overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. Class sizes are exploding. Resources are disintegrating. You know, which brings us to the work that Day One is doing here in New York. Community education, supportive services, legal advocacy, leadership development. What are the lessons that you've learned here in New York that our listeners all over the country should be thinking about replicating?
Well, this responds to what we're doing and also what parents can be doing. As with many things, a little investment early will serve you well in the long run. So talking to your children or, you know, the kids in your class early about what a healthy relationship looks like, setting guidelines like that, and letting them understand what acceptable behavior is and is not, will really pay off later when your child comes to you and says, I'm not sure if this is okay, or I'm worried about a friend of mine who's going through this. So that's part of what Day One tries to bring to the picture. By going to schools, speaking directly to young people, or doing parent trainings or teacher trainings, as we do across New York City, to let adults know how to identify this issue and how to be a supportive presence for youth.
What's the legal status of bullying?
Well, the legal status in New York actually just changed, and this varies from state to state, but we just were successful in passing a law that allows dating relationships to get civil orders of protection, which was never the case before July of this year.
A 14-year-old can get a civil order of protection?
Yes, and previously they could only get criminal orders of protection, which were really not very helpful because young people just refused to talk to the police and wouldn't go through that system.
But are these not also enforced by the police?
They are. If violated, they are enforced by the police, but obtaining a civil order protection is a much simpler process and doesn't involve initially involving the police.
I see. And there's a secondary criminal threat, but not a primary criminal threat.
If the person against whom the order is issued respects the judge's order, then there'd be no reason the police ever would get involved. You go to family court, you explain what happened, each person has their chance to say what their position is, and the judge determines whether an order should be issued, and that's that. And there's no police involvement at all unless there's violation.
Are the schools explaining these to kids?
No.
No.
Well, that's honestly where we come into the picture.
Step one. Okay, Day One is the program. Is there a website, Stephanie?
Yes. Our website is www.dayoneny.org.
DayOneNY, as in New York, .org. Stephanie Nilva, the executive director. Stephanie, thanks for dropping by.
Thank
today.
You so much.
Great talking with you. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Harbin here with you. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Very well done.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
3.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the Liz Claiborne World Headquarters on their day to raise consciousness about the issues of violence against women. Neil Irvin is with me. He is the Vice President of Programs for an organization called Men Can Stop Rape. Their website, mencanstoprape.org. Chief architect of their award-winning The Men of Strength, MOST, M-O-S-T, club, with chapters in Washington, D.C., California, New York City, North Carolina, Ohio, and Uganda.
Yes.
Where in Uganda?
Olu, the capital.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. Tell us, men can stop rape. I mean, this is not something that, even a phrase, I think, that immediately comes to mind when people think about it. You know, obviously, most, in almost all cases of rape, men are the perpetrators. Mm-hmm. But how do you see men as the solution?
Well, I think exactly what you say, Tom, is that, yes, overwhelmingly when convictions or incidents of sexual assault occur or domestic violence, it's men perpetrating that violence. But what that statistic doesn't speak to is that the majority of us as men will not necessarily perpetrate an incident. So that there's more of us not perpetrating than there are men who are perpetrating. The goal for us is to say to men who are not being violent that it's not good enough to say, I haven't raped anybody, I don't, you know, commit domestic violence, so I have no role in preventing it or reducing it.
Right.
Men Can Stop Rape believes that as men, masculinity, healthy masculinity, real strength requires us to be involved and be allies with women in preventing violence against women. That's not being anti-male when we talk about the realities of men being violent against women,
mm-hmm.
But it's an understanding of the critical nature, the critical healthcare issue that is for us all in society.
You know, there was a huge debate in the as the women's movement was emerging in the 60s,
mm-hmm.
and into the early 70s. Where there was a large faction that was suggesting that rape had nothing to do with sex, and was entirely about violence and dominance,
mm-hmm.
and then another group suggesting no, rape is testosterone mediated. It's, you know, I mean, look at who does it, and it's not about violence, it's about sex.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't been following that debate, frankly, for 20 years. I'm curious what the state of thinking is on that.
I would say to you that it's probably that debate still goes on, which is why we focus not on statistics or people's theoretical frameworks around, you know, whether it is sex or is it violence, why we focus on prevention and really focusing on masculinity. You know, the debate around that issue can go on forever if people choose just to disagree. What we'd rather do is have a discussion about what are the attitudes, behaviors, concepts of masculinity that create the need for a discussion like that. You know, many times we talk about the victim, what she did, where she was, what she did, who she did it with, versus talking about the perpetrator.
Right.
And for us, the prevention piece allows us to discuss how is it that a man thought it was okay, whether it be sexual or violence, that was an okay expression or use of his strength.
It sounds like what you're talking about, Neil Irvin, is with MenCanStopRape.org, is essentially reframing the definition of masculinity,
mm-hmm.
and reframing it in a way that a man is a complete man when he can empathize with and not take the role of a woman. Help me with the words here.
Yeah, I think it becomes what we understand about masculinity and the work we do with men. You know, we know it becomes dangerous when we start talking about alternative masculinity or a recreated masculinity. That's not what we're looking to do as much as we're trying to highlight what we understand as positive about masculinity, that mm-hmm. our strength isn't for hurting, and that real masculinity, healthy masculinity, real men recognize our roles in being allies and collaborators in moving our community forward and being inspirational with our strength. So when we talk about redefining masculinity, I think it's, as you're saying, we're really kind of relaunching, highlighting what has always been there in terms of the humanity that is within any of us to empathize or sympathize, and again, to be proactive in creating healthy environments for everyone. I mean, we as men, we benefit when violence against women is reduced, because many of the survivors of violence are mothers, our daughters, our cousins, our coworkers, our colleagues, our classmates. So for us, we don't want to get into a sticky debate of, oh, you're pushing some particular agenda. We're not.
Yeah.
But we're really trying.
This isn't about becoming a metrosexual.
No. I mean, you know, if that's who you are, that's who you are. We're not into that discussion either. We're in a place of, for us, if you're defining yourself as strong, as your humanity as a benefit, there's no way that you can ignore this. And
how do you redefine masculinity as strong in support and defense of women without stepping over the line into it being patronizing?
Well, I think it's a balance, as clear as you say. You know, women have been doing this work for many, many years out of the necessity of their lives and their own physical safety. And so for men to show up and say, we're here now, we're going to do it. We're not supermen. You know, because I do this work, I'm not special. We're not knights in shining armor. Again, we're engaging our humanity. And we recognize that women are clearly the lead in this work, but that there's a role for us. I can speak to men, Tom. You can speak to men in a way that the women here today supporting It's Time to Talk with Liz Claiborne could not do. And we understand that that's a resource in doing this work.
Yeah. I've lost it now, but the Guardian has a story up now about how in Iraq you can have your wife killed for $100. You know, it's just that's the going rate. No risk of jail, or your daughter, or your girlfriend, you know, $100 for honor killings. This is something that is transcends all national borders and all national boundaries. What are the programs, and you have programs both in Africa and the United States. Neil Irvin, in the half a minute or so we have left, what are the specific things that you recommend we be paying attention to and doing?
Well, first, prevention. Prevention work with young men to help them understand what healthy masculinity looks like in terms of healthy communication, healthy dating practices, healthy health care practices for themselves, that being strong and being violent is the example of what healthy masculinity is capable of, that it maximizes everybody's opportunity.
Wait a minute, you mean being strong and being violent are opposites?
Are opposites.
Right.
To be strong without being violent should be the goal.
That's
that
right.
we're not trying to turn you into something other than who you are, but that real masculinity requires a strength that is not only of the physical, but of an intellect.
Well said. Neil Irvin, and his program is mencanstoprape.org is the website.
Yes, that is
Neil,
it.
Thanks a lot for dropping by.
Thank you, Tom, for having us.
Great talking with you.
Appreciate it.
It's 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Liz Claiborne. Oh, here's Ellen Ratner. Ellen, I just came on the air, but here, I just want you to just stick your face in front of the microphone and say hello.
Hello,
hi.
Tom.
Hi, Ellen. It's great to
see you. I was just showing you my BlackBerry. Senator Mel Martinez is not going to seek re-election to quote-unquote spend time with his family. Somebody can't get re-elected.
Well, thanks. Yeah, thanks for the story. And I see also
or is in some other trouble that we don't know about.
Yep, and we're here at this anti-violence thing that Liz Claiborne put on. And I notice over in the far corner, Alan Combs, and he's been holding the hand of that woman who's teaching about bullying. Is she counseling him for his years with Hannity?
What?
Alan Combs is over there.
Yeah.
Was she counseling him for his years with Hannity, helping him with
grief? You know what I said to him? I said, you need PTSD treatment.
That's what I meant.
Great minds think alike.
There you go. Ellen, thanks so much for dropping by. Great to see you. Kevin Zeese is on the line with us. He's the executive director and co-founder of CFACP, Voters for Peace and True Vote. A couple of websites, freshaircleanpolitics.net, and the one that I find particularly interesting right now, breakthebailout.com. Kevin, you and I have been sparring partners in the past. We've been on the same side and opposite sides of issues and people, and I have always respected your intellect and your enthusiasm and your commitment to this nation. Welcome to the show.
Very nice to hear you again. I have the same feelings about you.
Well, thank you, and welcome back.
We usually agree on issues. It's when it gets to elections that we have trouble.
Yeah.
Luckily, that's behind us.
Yeah, there you go. And breakthebailout.com, you're suggesting with this website that there are better ways to solve the economic crisis than to hand hundreds of billions, thousands of billions, trillions of dollars to bankers who are unaccountable to us, who are not telling us how they're using the money, who are certainly putting large chunks of it in their own pockets and maybe in their Swiss bank accounts, that this isn't the best way to solve our problem.
Well, it obviously isn't. We already have literally put in trillions of dollars into
this.
You say
it's obviously not, but, you know, Henry Paulson disagrees.
And well, of course he does. He does disagree, and I'm sure most of Wall Street disagrees and big finance disagrees because they're the ones benefiting from this. We're seeing foreclosures and bankruptcies continuing, unemployment rising, the stock market going crazy, up one week, down the next, and so things are not getting better despite trillions of dollars being put into it. And BreakTheBailout.com is a transpartisan effort where we're lying with I'm on the progressive side, of course, and we're lying with people on the libertarian side. Because we noticed that when the bailout was first stopped in Congress, it was a left-right combination. We've seen the left-right combination forming in the Senate with one of my favorites, Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont, and Daniel Inhofe of Oklahoma, both coming out against the bailout. And so we're trying to bring that coalition together to stop the bailout. Then we're going to advocate for what we want, which is an economy that really puts the people's interests before the bankers' interests.
So breakthebailout.com is the website. Kevin Zeese, our guest. How do we break the bailout, Kevin? You mean just pass a law that says, sorry, guys, no more cash? What about the $700 billion that's already been passed out, or the $300 and change plus the trillion and change that the Fed has backed up?
That's a key point. That it's only been 300 and change that's been sent out so far. And one of the good changes that was made after the bailout was first stopped was in the 400-page bill that did pass, required the Treasury Department to come back and get their, you know, next installment. And
they're talking about it right now.
That's right. Well, and this is the time to stop it. We have a click and send letter on freshairthemepolitics.net. People can send a letter to their congressman and senator urging them to stop the next payment of the bailout. I think if people speak out in Congress right now and say no to the next installment, they won't even ask for it. They're already feeling very insecure about their performance. They've been really tacking back and forth the way they approach the bailout, you know, from toxic assets to putting money in their banks. They don't really, it seems like they're inconsistent with what they're trying to do. They're not even confident themselves, and so it's pretty hard to keep giving them money when they're not even sure what they're doing. We need to be investing in creating a new economy. That's where the money needs to go, and I'm glad that's being talked about. And we need to make sure that economic stimulus really becomes an economic transformation, because we can't keep on giving out corporate welfare in the hundreds of billions of dollars a year without some kind of control and return to the American taxpayer. We need an equity stake in that kind of corporate welfare in the new economy so that we share in the wealth, we share in the control and the direction the country goes. We can't just have a non-democrat economy. Right. We need to have people involved in setting the direction of the economy, which is so important to everything.
Kevin Zeese, Henry Paulson, and the whole bunch of them, but, I mean, you know, he's the front guy for this thing. He increasingly seems to me to be behaving like a very, very badly drunken guy in a house that he's totally unfamiliar with at night when somebody pulled the electric switch and all the lights are off. He keeps stumbling over the furniture. He's not quite sure how to, you know, I mean, doesn't it, you know.
That's a great image.
I see nothing to contradict it. I mean, you know, he's just stumbling from room to room and knocking over different furniture, but it's, you know, so.
It doesn't inspire confidence.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. And, you know, I have, you know, specific ideas about what we should do. I think, frankly, we need to immediately raise the minimum wage to $14 an hour. We need to pass the Employee Free Choice Act and make for unionization. We need to put tariffs in place on the import of goods that are just basically, let's just scale right back to 1980 and say whatever the tariffs were in 1980, that's what they are today instantly. And they were not high in 1980, by the way. They were relatively low compared to the 1950s or the 1940s or the 1930s,
right,
even.
That's right.
And just reboot the economy, basically. Let's just reboot this sucker. And by the way, $14 an hour as a minimum wage would be about what the minimum wage should be if wages had kept up with productivity all these years. Actually, it should be even higher than $14. It would be closer to $16. So that's my...
And that's also where the new hires are at the UA, you know, in the automobile industry. It's about that.
That's what they're paying them. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, what should be minimum wage? You know, obviously, I think people should make more than that, but you know, you have to have entry level jobs. So that's my plan. What's yours?
One thing I'd add to your plan would be, a tax on the wealthy. We've seen this
roll back the Reagan tax cuts.
Yeah, and not only roll back, but look at the increase in the wealth divide. I mean, the top 1% has the wealth equal to the bottom 95%. I mean, that is just obscene. And we can have a put a surtax on people making more than $5 million a year and raise hundreds of millions of dollars. We could begin to tax transactions on Wall Street, which right now you pay for when you buy food, clothing, and shelter, you pay a tax, but not when you buy stocks, bonds, and derivatives.
Right.
And so a tax on that to help pay for this mess. There's a lot more room for taxation than is talked about in our corporate media,
And in fact, when we raised taxes in the 1930s, it led to a sustained period of slow but steady, strong actually, but steady.
Now look at the 1960s. What was it, 90% tax rate for the top people?
And that's right.
That didn't slow down the growth of the 1960s.
Nope. In fact,
even under Reagan, it was at 50%. A tax rate. Now we're down in the 30s. It's way, and it's been class warfare going on since the 1980s.
Well, and what happens is when you drop those top marginal tax rates, it does away with the incentive for people to keep money in their business.
That's
right. I mean, you know, I think of this for a moment. If you're a businessman and let's say it's a small business, because, you know, the cons love to talk about, oh, I don't want to hurt the small businessman, right? So you've got a small business and you've got, you know, a couple $100,000 or $1 million or whatever sitting in, at the end of the year. You're going to have to pay taxes on that or what, right? Now, if your personal income tax rate is only 15%, if you can take it as capital gains or dividends, or even at 30%, let's say it's 30%, you can simply write yourself a paycheck and take the money and, you know, hey, you know, put it in a Swiss bank account, buy a yacht or something. On the other hand, if that top personal tax rate is 90%, I think the average small businessman would do what I was doing as a businessman back in the 70s and 80s when the tax rates were that high, and saying, you know, it's crazy for me to write myself a paycheck now that, you know, once I'm over the at least the 50% level, and instead I'm going to buy new equipment, I'm going to hire new people, I'm going to get some advertising, I'm going to do all those tax deductible things that I can do with that money so that I don't have to pay taxes on it, and the consequence of that is going to be that my business is going to grow rather than my paycheck or rather than my
bank balance. I think the other point I think we're seeing right now, in addition to the corporate welfare coming with the bailout, which is really something that's not unusual, it's actually common, hundreds of billions of dollars in corporate welfare. What we're also seeing is with the auto industry, three things. Detroit is getting a lot of blame for where things are going with their industry, but there's really blame to go around. You know, the health insurance issue. GM is spending $5 billion a year on health insurance. The three automakers have a $90 billion.
We need a universal health care program.
Exactly.
Tomorrow morning.
The credit, and it needs to be single payer.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, Kevin, we've got it all figured out. All we need to do is take over Congress, and we might actually be close to that. Kevin, in fact, we'll be talking with Andy Barr on Al Franken's Senate run here at the end of the hour. Kevin Zeese, Executive Director, BreakTheBailout.com and FreshAirCleanPolitics.net. Kevin, thanks so much for being with us
today.
Thanks
for having me on.
Always great talking with you, Kevin. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border, and streaming around the planet on Air America Radio. We're broadcasting live from the Liz Claiborne World Headquarters, their Awareness of Violence Against Women Day, and speaking out on these issues. We've talked with a number of people who've been speaking, who have told us the stories of children who have experienced violence. This is where it gets really real. Elizabeth Crescente is with us. Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I'm the father of three children. I cannot imagine, I can't even allow myself to imagine what it must be like to lose a child. You have founded this organization, Jennifer's Hope, for the Prevention of Teen Violence, named after your daughter, Jennifer.
Yes.
Yeah. Tell the story. Tell us that story.
Well, 2.5 years ago, my daughter's ex-boyfriend at that time, let me back up just a little. She dated him for 2 years, And during that time, there was no physical abuse. However, there was a lot of emotional abuse. And it was profoundly controlling. He, for example, did the things that you've been hearing about today, telling her what to wear, who she could be with, isolating her from me. In addition, though, every time she tried to break it off or do something that he didn't like, he would attempt suicide. Not threaten, but attempt. And so I think that without being violent, that's one of the most profoundly violent things that you could
do. Well,
it
is violent. It's self-directed violence, but it's still violence.
Yeah, and he told her that she was the only one who could save him. And so that really snagged her. He then got into a lot of trouble. He was incarcerated for 6 months. And before I really knew that he had been released, she decided that she wanted to try and be his friend, still try to help him stay, clean, stay where he needed to be. And he had, unbeknownst to us, been planning to kill her for up to 9 months. So a lot of times people think this was a crime of passion, but it wasn't. He planned it for a long, long time, and we will never know why. But what he did was, the day after Valentine's Day, 2006, he took her into a wooded area by our house, and he shot her.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, there came a time where I wasn't really sure if I wanted to be here or not without her.
Yeah.
And I decided that I did, and the only way I knew how to do that was to advocate.
Yeah, and so you have started Jennifer's Hope, the website jennifershope.org.
Mm-hmm.
And tell us about Jennifer's Hope.
Jennifer's Hope is a grassroots organization. However, I thought it would be the seed of an idea that would slowly grow, and truthfully, it exploded and blossomed in mass. So I started advocating in Austin, then statewide, quickly nationwide, and now I've been invited to speak in Britain, so I'm pretty excited about that. And then, of course, I'm here today for the Time to Talk roundtable discussions with Liz Claiborne, just an amazing resource. I work with them in Austin. That's where the Teen Dating Abuse Helpline is housed.
Mm-hmm.
So I work with them.
Is this
there.
A national helpline?
It is a national helpline. The domestic hotline is also housed in Austin as well. And so I've worked with both of those folks. And in Jennifer's Hope also in 2009 is coming out with a program where high school kids will be doing a citywide competition, and they will sponsor and fundraise and advocate for an event, say Battle of the Bands or right. Slam Poetry or something like that. So we're looking forward to 2009 and getting that off the ground.
We're talking with Elizabeth Crescente, the founder of Jennifer's Hope. Jennifershope.org is the website. Elizabeth, we have about 2 minutes here. If a parent or grandparent sees the kind of controlling behaviors you described this young man asserting over your daughter, what should they do?
Well, one thing is they can call this helpline. We have parents that call in all the time.
Is the numbers on your website at jennifershope.org?
It is. It's the Teen Dating Abuse Helpline, the Liz Claiborne Helpline. And what that is a national resource, and they can get you connected with any local resource wherever you are. And so you can start the conversation. I'll tell you that my belief is that we shouldn't start in high school. We should start in elementary school.
Right.
Jennifer's Hope vision is to prevent, not intervene, not put out fires that have already started.
Right. And not just educate the girls to look out for this, but educate the boys that if they find themselves doing this, they need to get help.
That's an excellent point and close to my heart, because my daughter's ex-boyfriend was failed in many capacities by the courts, by all kinds of therapists. And if he had had successful intervention, my daughter would be alive today.
Yeah, that's a tough one. And I honor you for turning tragedy into something that will hopefully prevent many other tragedies.
It's a
marvelous thing you're doing. Elizabeth Crescente, the founder, jennifershope.org, the website. Check it out. Elizabeth, thank you for dropping by today.
Thank you so much.
Great talking with you. It is 27 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270. Our telephone number. We'll be picking up your phone calls on your choice of the topics for the day. A lot going on, a lot we've covered right after this break. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Tommy here with you. 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Boy, crazy stuff going on out there in the world. I'll tell you, it's just downright nuts, especially over in the O'Reilly department. Believe it or not, Bill O'Reilly, not only, well, I'll just, here it is in his own words about Guantanamo Bay. I think.
You know, there are accusations of mistreatment at Guantanamo, but there's certainly no proof that ever happened.
Right, Bill. No proof there was ever anything that went wrong at Guantanamo. He's nuts. I'm telling you, he's nuts. Bill of the Clown, once again, going down in flames when it comes to, you know, like the humanity thing or the intelligence thing or the functional. Anyway. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Laura in Miami, Florida. Hey, Laura, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you?
Good, good. Good to talk to you. You know, I've kind of had my political awakening this year with the whole Obama-McCain thing, and I ordered the book you recommended, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America.
By Harvey Kay. Isn't that a brilliant book?
I haven't read it yet, but I got it in order. And I was just at a rally in my school. We had one of these guys, you know, with signs that was saying that, you know, fear God and all these things. And there were a lot of things being said back and forth about the founding fathers and what they intended. And some people were saying that they were deists and some people were saying they were transcendentalists. And from what I see, there's a lot of discrepancy out there. I was wondering if there was any other book that you could recommend, like a good, you know, solid history book on the foundation of America, maybe something not biased that, you know, could really give some clear answers.
Well, Harvey Kay's is absolutely one of the very best. Another great book, which is seeing the founding through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson, is Fawn Brody's book, which is, I think it's now out of print because I believe that she's died. But you can easily find used copies of it all over the place because it was a huge, you know, New York Times bestseller maybe a decade ago. And it's
that's Seeing Through the Eyes of Thomas Jefferson?
No. The title of it is simply Thomas Jefferson, An Intimate Biography by Fawn, by Fawn Brody, B-R-O-D-I-E. And it's about 600-800 pages, and it's just it's one of those you can't put it down. I mean, it reads just brilliantly. She is such a brilliant writer, as is Harvey Kay with his Thomas Paine and the founding of America.
Okay. And I would think, too, reading the Constitution would be a good thing, huh?
I would strongly suggest that you actually read the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. They're not difficult. They're not legalese. They're fascinating. Maybe even before you read those books, it'll certainly provide some context. The books that I've written that, you know, not to excessively plug my own stuff, but that have to do with the history of America, by and large, are We the People, which is a 130-page illustrated novel style book that I think is probably one of the most history-rich and dense books, including stuff about the religion of the founders. It's called We the People. And then What Would Jefferson Do? And Unequal Protection is about the 1886 Supreme Court case. And then, of course, Screwed gets into some of that stuff. There are a number of other historians. Howard Zinn's History of America is excellent. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff out there
Howard whom?
Howard Zinn, Z-I-N-N. He's a brilliant historian. You know, I have some disagreements with Howard in some areas. On the other hand, I would never.
That's okay, we need that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he's just, you know, his worldview, when you read his history of America, and there, it's actually out in a cartoon form now as well, comic book form, which is a little more readable. It's very easy to get cynical. It's very easy to you know, they were all bums, you know, that kind of thing. And mm-hmm. and I don't view it that way, and frankly, neither does Harvey Kay or Fawn Brody. But I understand that worldview. I understand that point of view. I'm just not sure it's all that useful. On the other hand, it's impossible to deny that, you know, we're a nation that was founded and grounded in genocide and you know, has a pretty horrible past. But we were also founded in an idealism that hadn't been seen in 3,000 years since the Greek, you know, attempt in Athens. And I think that needs to be focused on.
And it's getting harder and harder to keep up that idealism. You know, I get slack from my family all the time, but, you know, that's why I want to read these things.
Yeah, and well, those would be great places, in my opinion, to start, and I think you'll find them really good. And as far as the founders being deists and not and all that sort of thing, there's one right-wing guy, I'm forgetting his last name, his first name is David, who has literally made up a bunch of quotes from the founders that would imply, particularly Jefferson and Washington, that would imply that they were Bible-thumping Christians. And these books, these quotes that he has made up, have literally made their way into, they're openly in a whole bunch of Christian homeschooling curriculum textbooks, but they've even made their way into some of the mainstream textbooks. You'll find them quoted all over the web when people on these websites that are trying to assert that the founders wanted America to be a theocracy and that they were heavy-duty Christians and all this kind of stuff. And when you see that David guy, whatever his last name is, it's Braxton or Braden or something like that, know that what you are really reading are lies. The fact of the matter is some of the founders were. Patrick Henry, for example, was he was a Jerry Falwell fundamentalist. And some of his speeches are just, you know, really, really intense. Patrick Henry was a real true believer Christian. On the other hand, you know, you read the letters between Jefferson and John Adams, for example, who was his political enemy from the time Adams was president and Jefferson was his vice president until just a few years before they died when they reconciled by mail. They never again talked to each other in person. And they wrote their letters back and forth, and there's a beautiful letter. It's in one of my books, I think it's in We the People, where Adams writes to Jefferson. He says, you know, the Christians are waiting for the return of Jesus, the Jews are waiting for the Messiah, the Muslims are waiting for the return of Muhammad. Every religion seems to be looking for its you know, he said, but we have to, you know, turn our hearts and turn our minds to creating a better society with what we have, you know. And it's very mm-hmm. practical thing. Even though John Adams was a good, as I recall, Episcopalian or Presbyterian, Jefferson was clearly a deist and bragged about it, his writings. In fact, if you go to Google and just Google Tom Hartman in quotes and Judge Moore in quotes, you'll find an article that I wrote for Common Dreams about 3 years ago about Judge Moore, in which I've got just a whole series of quotes from Jefferson, Adams, Madison, and others about religion and the founding of this country that I think you'll find very, very useful. So I got to move along, great. But I hope that's a great start, Laura. And
thank you so much.
And good on you for caring enough to want to learn more. I appreciate it. Thank you very much for the call.
All right. Thank you for what you do. Bye.
Thank you. Good talking with you. Mike in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Plenty. I'm enjoying your show, and I'm really so very happy that you're picking up the crusade for keeping jobs in America. And I mean, I know you always have, but I like the added enthusiasm with which you're going at it.
If we don't, we're screwed. I mean, we're going to end up a third world country. We're halfway there already.
You know, I have a small business in Milwaukee, a photography studio, and my small business right-wing friends who have studios, my fellow photographers, I try to talk to them. I said, look, how many rich people do you have using you? And not any of them could say, I have a lot of rich people using me. I said, most of the people that use you are people that are making a living wage and that have a little bit more
above that, that they can afford to come to your studio, because we're not cheap either, you know.
Sure.
And I said, you got to start supporting unions. You got to support working class people, and they're not the enemy. And but my main thing is, and I know you've had him on your show. This guy is brilliant. I think he's a Nobel Prize winning economist. Not besides Krugman, but Ravi Batra, who was. Who's the guy with the big ears? I hate to make fun of him. I'm not making fun of him. What's his name?
Well, Ravi Batra is the economist who's on our show regularly. He's a professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, R-A-V-I-B-A-T-R-A, and that's his website, ravibatra.com. And he's the author of two brilliant books, Greenspan's Fraud, which is tells you everything you need to know about what's happened from 1980 up until about 5 years ago, and then The New Golden Age, which is his book about, in which he predicted, you know, 3 years ago when he wrote the book, the election of Barack Obama.
You know, Ross Perot, that's the guy I was trying to think of.
Ross Perot. Yeah, he was right, you know, he was the giant sucking sound. The crazy old coot Ross Perot was absolutely right.
He was. Didn't he say something about if you go this way, you're going to hear this big rushing sound, and that's
giant sucking sound is what he said. Yeah.
And yes. Ravi Batra was his economic advisor. He was.
Really?
Yeah. He was sticking up for him, and I think he was traveling around the country talking on behalf of.
Doesn't surprise.
Of Ross Perot.
Doesn't surprise me.
If you could have him on again, give him a little more time than your average guest, I think he'll really inform the public.
Oh, we do. Ravi's every 2 or 3 weeks, typically Ravi comes on for an hour, you know, or at least a half hour, very often an hour, takes calls. He's one of our regulars and one of our favorite people and one of my favorite people just as a person. But, if you really want to understand, you know, modern economics, both macro and microeconomics, and don't even want to know what those words mean. You know, in other words, you don't want to get into techie talk, but you really want to understand economics. Go to Ravi Batra, RAVIBATRA.com, and pick up, or any bookstore, and pick up copies of his two books, his two most recent books, Greenspan's Fraud and The New Golden Age. They're just brilliant. And I kind of like my book, Screwed, which covers much of that same stuff, too. You know, the undeclared war against the middle class and what we can do about it. We'll be right back.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Yeah, speaking of not meaning a thing, Congressman Duncan Hunter, you know, the crazy Republican, the son of the former GOP presidential candidate. This is the new freshman congressman from California. There's more violence in Tijuana than in Iraq and Afghanistan. And Saxby Chambliss, he says, don't call my support for privatizing Social Security privatization. You shouldn't use that word when I talk about privatizing Social Security. I mean, it's just really not that. Is it? Oh, my. Andy Barr is with us. Andy is the Grand Poobah. Actually, I think his official title is Communications Director, but Grand Poobah sounds so much better. For Al Franken Senate Run over at alfranken.com. Andy, welcome to the show. Andy? We just lost him. Okay. We're going to get him back on. We will attempt to get him back on. We're doing that. And in that case, I want to go back to a couple of these things. This is in October, the chairman of the Virginia GOP, this poor, pathetic, crazy guy named Jeff Frederick, compared, now this, keep in mind, before the election, compared Barack Obama to Osama bin Laden. He had this, he thought it was the funniest thing he'd ever come up with, right? He told an audience, both have friends who have bombed the Pentagon. Ha ha ha, chuckle, chuckle, tee hee, roar, roar. Yeah. So he was asked today, you want to apologize for comparing bin Laden to Barack Obama or vice versa? He said, no. No, what I said was true, he said. I mean, have these guys no shame? Have they none? I mean, it's incredible. Chris Wallace, defending Bush's abuse of power, he says that comparing George Bush to Richard Nixon is a gross misreading of history. Keep in mind, Richard Nixon was impeached for breaking into the Watergate Hotel to wiretap Democrats, to listen in on a couple of Democrats. And here you've got an administration that's listening in on everybody. Anyhow, as I said earlier, the grand poobah for the Al Franken Senate campaign, actually communications director, but I like grand poobah as a title. Andy Barr is with us, alfranken.com, of course, the website. Andy, 73 votes?
Try 50 votes, Tom. The margin continues to get narrower and narrower every day. We believe that with about 200,000 votes left to be counted as of this morning, that the margin is 50 votes. So that's pretty amazing considering that, almost 3 million votes were cast. And when they're all counted, we're feeling pretty good that Al Franken's going to be the next senator from Minnesota.
Andy, explain to us what's going on with these challenged votes. I keep reading about and hearing about, there's this challenge vote and that challenge vote and these many thousands and the challenged votes and the absentee votes that haven't been counted. What's going on here?
Well, and you're right to separate out the two, Tom. On the challenges, the way this works is, and you've probably seen this in other states, election officials are by hand going back through the ballots that were originally counted by machine. They're either saying, well, this is a vote for Franken, this is a vote for Coleman, this is a vote for somebody else, I can't tell what this is a vote for, and each campaign has observers at each table that allow them to, you can make challenges if you think that the election judge's call is wrong. And by the way, I'm glad you mentioned the website alfranken.com. That's one of the reasons we still need people's support, is that we're deploying over 2,000 people across the state to watch these tables. Now, the Coleman campaign has made several hundred more challenges than we have. We don't think it's really to anybody's benefit to try to game the system by running up a whole bunch of challenges. We're able to look at the call made at the table by the election judge and get a pretty good sense of where things stand, which is where we got our margin of 50 votes.
But does the Coleman campaign think that it's a good thing to try and game the system?
Apparently, if you look at some of the news reporting here, they'll say the margin is 350 votes or something like that, and you think, well, gosh, that's different than what Andy's on Hartman saying, and the reason for that is that the Coleman folks have challenged way more ballots than we have. When the Secretary of State is doing its math, and that's what you see reported in the mainstream media, it'll take any ballot that's challenged and just put it aside into a challenge pile, right. And that ballot comes out of the count until the state canvassing board takes a look at them in a couple weeks. We don't really see the point in making frivolous challenges that are just going to be overturned by the canvassing board in a couple weeks anyway.
Ultimately, what is going to be, right? I mean, there's nothing beyond that. There's not some way that either campaign, for that matter, can make a magic statement or push a magic button or whatever. So the bottom line, we have a minute here left, Andy. Alfranken.com, what can our listeners do to most effectively support you in the work that you're doing?
Well, honestly, I know it's been a long campaign, and we've had a lot of support from listeners of the Tom Hartman Show and Air America, but we still need contributions. And the reason? Well, we've kept the campaign open 2 months longer than we thought. That's an office, that's utilities, that's a staff. We're deploying 2,000 people all across the state. We've got legal bills that are, of course, mounting up as we fight to make sure that every vote is counted and that Norm Coleman can't walk away with this one until everyone's had their say.
Do you need volunteers as well, physical volunteers?
Yep, and you can go to the website also and let us know if you're able to help out that way. Again, alfranken.com, and we really appreciate any bit of help we can get.
Well done. Andy, thanks so much for the update.
All right, thank you, Tom.
Good luck, and give my very best to Al.
I absolutely will.
Great having you on.
Coming up tomorrow, self-described author, political consultant, former Fulbright fellow, and part-time ski instructor Larry Beinhardt is going to join me as we continue to investigate all this week the middle-class meltdown. Plus, we'll be talking with Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research on the trade deficit and the economic legacy. I'd call it a disaster. We're leaving our children. And the best of the rest of the news and your calls, of course. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, call everybody you know in Georgia, and go to alfranken.com as well. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit hartmanradio.com.